Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Productivity Mastery. As usual, we're going to bring you amazing guests. Every week, we're bringing you amazing guests from all around the world. Different type of expertise, but all around leadership, productivity, entrepreneurship. How can we be better, show up better, and give the best of who we are, build great businesses? Today, I have a fascinating guest. His name is Matthew Brackett. And I don't even know where to start this conversation. We're going to be unpacking his story, his leadership lessons he learned on the way. But Matthew, why don't we start with the picture? Prior to the podcast, you showed me this picture. And can you maybe share the story? Share with us the picture.
Of course.
Show the story.
We'll do a little show and tell. So yeah, Matthew Brackett. I'm in Mexico City. And so what I'm going to tell you has a lot to do with Mexico. I went to a dinner in darkness, it's called. Put on by a foundation that supports visually challenged or blind people. And they create this environment, which is totally dark. In other words, you can't see your fingers in front of your face. And so we have this three-course meal in darkness. And two things that it did for me, it enhances your other senses. So you kind of, you hear more, you feel more, the sensations and also the flavor of the food that you don't know what you're eating. And so you're sort of trying to discover what you're eating. And you're talking to people. And then halfway through the meal, we had to put like a puzzle together between all of us, even though we couldn't see anything. And then it's part of it also is creating sensitivity or an awareness around what visually challenged or blind people go through. So that was sort of, and the waiters, the people that served us and led us through the whole experience were blind people. And this is put on by a foundation called Ojos que Sienten, sort of eyes that feel. And part of the woman that started this foundation, you know, she can see, she's very sensitive towards people that are challenged in different ways from a very young age. She was like that. And so she started teaching photography to blind people. And from that, she started a foundation. And the picture that I showed you is a picture that was taken by a blind person. So they studied photography and they used their other senses to capture pictures. And so at the end of the meal, they auctioned off a few pictures. And so there's a picture that I bought to support the foundation. And also I have it here because it's a great story. It's impactful. And it's also just a beautiful picture of Mexican women in a very traditional town and traditional festivities in their dress. But the story behind it, I think is very powerful. Just about how meeting these people, their energy, their joy, their appreciation for what they are, for who they are, for what they can do, you know, and it's humbling for those of us, you know, for me that I couldn't see. And I was like, well, these people have so much to teach me. And I'm sure a lot of us, we come across experiences like that very often in life, how people that seemingly have less teach us so much more.
And why was this story so impactful to you? So you decided to begin our conversation prior to the podcast sharing this story.
Why?
Why was it so important to you?
It's so important to me because of just precisely what I just said is that people oftentimes I can get very negative about myself or about life because entrepreneurship is challenging. But when you see these other people, there's so much to be thankful for. And I was so thankful for meeting them and having that experience, because it also, it helped me value my eyesight. And it was like, also now I can see, and I want to see better. And this has a lot to do even with my story and with the way I work with people. I want to see people better. And this is directly linked to leadership. When there's basic needs that we have as human beings, without going into physiological needs, but the human person, we all want to be seen. We want to be listened to. We want to be valued. We want to be appreciated. We want to be recognized. And when we do this in romantic relationships, when we do this in family and inner circles, and when we do this in the workplace, people are more content, there's more connection, people are happier, performance is better. And so this is so basic, but this is something that sometimes a lot of people miss out on. We jump to other things about leadership. If we can start there, we will be so far ahead of the game. Now, and this is based for me, this is based on just the importance of the human person, the dignity of the human person. When we use people, well, we're not treating people with that dignity that they deserve and that they desire. Now, in the professional space, work is a professional transaction. I offer you my expertise or my services, my time, and you compensate that. So we have to start with that, because there's a big thing in today's workforce where, you know, we're almost like employees expect the company to do everything for them and make them happy, you know, well-being. So all that's important, but we have to remember it's a transaction and it's a professional transaction. So professionalism is very important, but also it's a human transaction, people dealing with people. And to remember, people, they want to be seen. They want to be listened to. You know, and if we think about that, and then if we think about my own senses, I can see people. Right? And oftentimes, you know, dealing with these blind people, even though they couldn't see me, I felt like they could see me because of the way they dealt with me. And that can happen even, I think, even with deaf people. You know, but we who have our senses, let's try to see better. Let's try to hear better. And value people better. That's why one of my motto in my own business is, let's lead better, love better, and live better. Because these are the wonderful things that we can do as human beings. And sadly, sometimes we fall short.
That was beautiful, man. Such a powerful reminder. Thank you so much for bringing this important topic to the front. People want to be seen. People want to be heard. People want to be appreciated in any kind of relationship, including in the workplace.
Right.
Many of the topics we explore here on the podcast are related to building a productive and caring culture, workplace. Right. And often we tend to focus a little bit too much on the more logical side of the things, the business results, the structure, the processes, the technical things, which are really important, but they shouldn't come at the expense on the human side.
Right.
Of building an environment that nurtures people.
That's right. Yes. And that has, and I think that just has automatic consequences, positive results on performance, engagement, and therefore on well-being, and where people are just more content. Because again, going back to that, when people feel seen, listened to, they're going to be more engaged. They're going to work better. Right. When they, it's very interesting that when I have a leader that I look up to, I'll almost do anything for that leader because I know that they'll do anything for me. But if I have a leader who comes across as selfish, as comes across as just, you know, very utilitarian, I'm going to hold back. Right? And when we talk about culture, I think culture is built on a few things. Is, you know, what values do we profess? And then how do our behaviors align with those values? You know, when I work with a lot of organizations, that's why I use this sort of the gap between, this is what we say we stand for, but this is the way we behave, right? The bigger the gap, the bigger the frustration and disappointment, and the more dysfunctional the culture. Okay. And culture starts at the top. And I can't stress this enough, because a lot of executives and leaders are like, you know, HR and our culture, but you take care of culture down at the bottom and we're going to continue to be the same. Right? You know, culture starts at the top. Right? You can say you stand for certain things, but if leadership is behaving a different way, people are going to behave the way you're behaving because that's what's acceptable. You know, and then so culture, another thing in leadership that's so important is and for culture is clarity of communication. One of the greatest gifts that we can give our people, and this is applied also in family or romantic life and also but in business, one of the greatest gifts that we can give our people is clarity of communication. And this is hard for us as human beings. Sometimes we have a hard time being clear. And so this means clarity of mission and vision. You know, who are we? What do we stand for? Why do we do what we do? What are the values that we profess and live by? What do results look like? What are my expectations for you as an employee and as someone who works with me? And also feedback is a very important part of clarity of communication. People, as human beings, we all want to know where we stand. And we have a hard time with ambiguity. So if we don't know where we stand, we're left guessing, trying to figure it out. And so we're in that awkward dance. This happens in romantic relationships and it happens in the workplace. When it's awkward dance, it's trying to figure out where we stand because no one's telling me. And I'm not only saying negative feedback, I'm saying positive. First and foremost, people, if we want to reinforce positive behaviors and promote positive behaviors, we have to let people know what we're appreciating and valuing about the way they're performing. And some leaders will say, no, but they're just doing their job. I'm not going to highlight that. Yes, but if you want to promote positive behaviors, well, it's important to highlight what you're appreciating so that people will continue to do it. Like, again, it goes back to what I said at the beginning. They realize that they're being seen. That even in the small things that they're doing well, someone's noticing. And that means a lot to us. And they will continue to do that. But if we're not saying that, people will, well, maybe this isn't what I'm supposed to do. Maybe it's not appreciated. Or maybe people don't care. And then there's the negative feedback or areas of opportunity or growth opportunity, whatever you want to call it. But the fact is that we all want to know, well, not necessarily we want to know. We all need to know how we can improve because this is very directly linked to expectations. But if you're not telling us, we're not telling our people. And this is how, and going back to what you said, a culture that cares. This is how we care for our people, because one of the responsibilities of a leader, as I said, is clarity of communication. Another responsibility of a leader is to develop their people. And that's why this whole part of feedback is so important, positive and negative. Right? Now, we as human beings, we have a hard time with difficult conversations. We're like, oh, I don't know, how do I do this? And well, do it because you care. And when it comes from a place of care, be honest, be upfront, right? Sometimes the people talk about the sandwich method, right? Say something positive, you know, kind of put the negative feedback in the middle and then say something positive. I'm not a huge fan of that because while you're saying something positive, the person is really waiting for you to say, but what I wanted to tell you is, and so they're really not paying attention to the positive. People, so if the people are just going to, they already know you've called them into the office or that you had a performance meeting and they're waiting for the areas of opportunity. So sometimes, you know, after you get over the pleasantries, lead with the areas of opportunities and then spend more also then at the end of the part to talk about all the things that you're valuing, that you're appreciating, that you want to continue to promote, you know, these positive behaviors. And because I think the danger there of beginning with the negative feedback or beginning with the positive is that people they're not listening. They're waiting for the meat of the sandwich, you know? And so think about how to present that. Anyways, I started going off on a tangent there, but this
can I share something?
Yes.
I feel like you're the third co-author of our book. Like literally, like if you open the book that we've written, it's called Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. I co-authored the book with Cristobal Alonso, who's the CEO of Startup Wise Guys, the leading European startup acceleration program. Oh. If you read the book, what you just described in the past 5 minutes is pretty much a summary of our book. Like 95%. Which is like I'm getting goosebumps because this is the core of everything. And just to, for those of you listening, if you haven't came across our framework, it's PERFORM stands for purpose and values. effective planning, roles and responsibilities, focus and execution, optimal energy, robust communication, mental toughness. The seven core pillars.
Look at that.
That if you pay attention to these pillars consistently as a leader, and a lot of the things that me and Machi talk about, you, the listener, you know them. I know them. Machi knows them. But how much do you do them consistently? How much do you provide clarity for every person from your team, what their priorities should be, what are their core responsibilities, what do you expect from them, how often do you make the time to give feedback,
right?
To provide the feedback in an effective way, and it could be hard, right? Because you're busy, you have so many things to do, but these are priorities. This should be priorities for every effective leader. It's not just the right thing to do because we are good human beings. It is actually effective for your business.
It is. It's effective for the bottom line, for results, for production, all that.
Matthew,
thank you. Before you continue, I want to say something about this, because in two of the things that I do, you know, I recommend with a lot of the mid and senior leadership that I deal with is, I really encourage them, and they start to implement it, that they have fixed meetings with their people, especially with their direct reports. This sounds like a no-brainer, but sometimes people don't have the time to do it. But this is great for preventive maintenance. It's great for that work, that people know that I have time with my boss, and so all the things that I need to talk to. In the end, I think it ends up saving time, and it ends up keeping things moving in the right direction rather than trying to pick up the pieces after. It keeps you as a leader. You have to stay one step ahead of the game. So calendarized, you know, programmed meetings with my direct reports or with other areas that are important to me, put them in your calendar and let them be fixtures that you build your life around, that you build your professional life around. The other thing that I do, you know, in coaching, and you've probably experienced this, but in my individual coaching and consultation, you know, calls, what's so important, it forces people, you know, impactful, high-performing influencers and leaders, it forces them to slow down. And this is, oftentimes we think we don't have time to slow down. But when we don't slow down, then we're not, to support your point, we're not paying attention to our priorities. So in our coaching sessions, it forces people to slow down for 45 minutes, where they begin to pay attention to what's going on around them, to the priorities, and they pay attention to what's going on inside of them. And this improves, indirectly, it improves self-awareness. And I say that self-awareness is one of the greatest leadership assets, and the lack of self-awareness, one of the greatest leadership liabilities. And a lot of people or leaders will say, that can't be that important. Well, if the more blind spots you have, the more perhaps dysfunctional or ineffective your leadership will be. So the less blind spots you have, and self-awareness is all about uncovering those blind spots, being stuff. And not only that, then self-awareness also improves my ability to be aware of those around me, directly linked to emotional and social intelligence. So that's why coaching sessions, that's one reason why coaching sessions can be so helpful for you. And it's not because the coach knows better. Oftentimes the coach doesn't. I'm not an expert in Stoyan. I'm not an expert in what you do. You are. But as a coach, I facilitate a process of discovery. So anyways, there we go. I know you were going to go somewhere else with this. Where do you want to go?
That's a very important point. And while you're speaking, it just to my mind came this quote. I don't know where it came from, but I'm going to read it. I just wrote it on my phone.
Yes.
As a business leader, don't forget the business of people.
Yes.
I just came up with it while we were speaking. So you brought it to me somehow.
Take care of your people, and your people are going to take very good care of you and of your business. Take care of your priorities, and your priorities are going to take good care of you.
And talking about people and loving people, I wonder whether this love for people and faith in people came to you through your experience as a priest. Can you maybe talk about that? Why did you become a priest, and what did you learn about leadership being a priest?
There's so much there. So yeah, so for your audience, so I'm the 10th of 13 children from a small town in New England. And I left small town New England at the age of 18 to partly I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So that's why I left. And I knew I didn't want to stay there.
Which town is that?
It's a small town called Harvard, Massachusetts. It's okay. the same name as the university, but it's...
Is that close to... No, it's not. It's... Is it east or west of Boston?
It's central. It's east. So it's central Massachusetts. West of Boston. There's nothing east of Boston. Just the ocean.
This Cape Cod. I used to live on Cape Cod, actually. I spent a couple of summers in Cape Cod. So I was wondering if you see Harwich or... But
No. Central Massachusetts, very small, those typical small New England towns with the colonial houses.
Got it. So it's like I don't want to stay here. I wanna go out.
Right. I'm from a large family of being there. I was like, I want to do something. And since I grew up in a very faith-based environment, I was like, I want to do something meaningful, impactful, something that lasts not only in time but in the afterlife and eternity. But at the same time, I didn't know what. And so I saw this journey, joining this religious organization and to become a priest. I saw that as, well, this is meaningful. This requires heroism. And we were brought up knowing that heroism is important. Sacrifice is important. And so I said, well, this is hard. this seems heroic and extreme. And so that must be my path. So that's what I did, and that's where I was. For 30 years. I was 18.
You were 18.
18. So that's what I did. So I went on that journey, and I didn't look back. Probably for about 25 years, and then I began to look. I was like, oh boy, what, you know, this in trans, you know, in transformational moments in life, or transition moments. I say that they can come to us through three different doors: through the door of love, through the door of dreams, or through the door of pain. You know, and I think it was dreams and love that led me to do what I did, but then it was the door of pain that led me to question and say, well, is this the right place for me? And for a lot of different reasons. You know, sort of living in conflict with myself, somewhat of conflict with the human side of the organization. And I'm not saying that all that justifies, you know, the decision I made. I'm just sort of saying why. But then it was also about my health. I was burnt out. I was going through years of depression, of mild depression. But again, that when you don't take care of it, it's obviously going to get worse. And I think part of just living in conflict and sort of like putting on, I think I lost, what I would say is I lost myself in the process, because it's all about identity, so important for us as human beings. And I was living all these identities from a very early age. I was put in very important leadership roles. So, you know, I had the collar, I was the priest, I was this, I was that. But who was I? You know, and if we don't have this strong foundation of who we are as human beings, if my identity is I'm the speaker, I'm the boss, I'm the CEO, this is what, right, or I'm the military, or I'm, at some point, I'm going to get a costly bill. And it's gonna cost me some of my priorities.
And you know, one of the things about the importance of coaching is exactly this self-awareness that you create, because sometimes it's very difficult for somebody to really distinguish between what are my own values and beliefs and what are the values and beliefs that I picked on the way. Perhaps from my upbringing, perhaps from my teachers, the school, my peer group, and which of those values and beliefs I subconsciously still follow, as opposed to going deeper and looking inside of who am I really and what makes me happy, what makes me who I am.
Yes, who am I? Like you said, who am I? How do I align, you know, to live in alignment with who we are is really important, because when we live in contradiction or in conflict, it begins to wear us out emotionally, right? Mentally, psychologically, spiritually. Right? And over time that can really take. Now, again, personality styles are different. I think I'm sort of a forward thinker. And when you're in highly structured hierarchical organizations, I began to realize I was just living kind of like always running into a wall, right? Because you want to make changes. You want things to be different. You want things to be better. But these large organizations, and I'm not saying just, you know, the Catholic Church or religious orders. I come across this in very large global organizations that I work with, that I coach some of the leaders in. And some people live frustrated because the organization is this big monster and they can't effect change. Some people are okay with that. You know, so it's, I think part of it's personality style. Other people can't do with it. And then it's sort of like, well, then they have to make a decision. Just, this isn't a place for me if it doesn't really align properly. And if I feel like I'm just wearing myself out. Or I choose just to be kind of, just to submit and to be passive and just get the paycheck, do the job, and not ruffle feathers. And in large organizations, a lot of people choose to do that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. Everyone has to find the way to make it work for our own well-being, right? For the well-being of our loved ones. So anyway, that's, I forget where I was going with this, but that was what led to my decisions, you know? And so, I mean, I did some, you know, I made mistakes along the way. I would, you know, I think when I was just not in a good mental state, you can make mistakes. Again, this is a great important thing for entrepreneurs, leaders. Okay, if we don't take care of ourselves, we do run the risk of making poor decisions, right? That will affect us, affect our organization, affect the people that we lead. And it doesn't come from a place of ill will, but it's just a natural consequence. But at one point, I just, you know, I raised my little white flag and I said, you know what? Time out, right? And so I took a sabbatical year. I went into inpatient care for 4 months to really deal with a lot of stuff that I was carrying for a number of years. You know, I was in a crisis and I'm very passionate about crisis. Crisis is a hard word for us as human beings, but we will all face them there. And crises can be transformational when we face them in a proper way.
Matthew, I'm gonna pause here because probably there are 6 or 7 places I want to zoom in a little bit from the story that you shared. And the first part is, for my audience, for myself, I think it's going to be really interesting to hear a little bit more about your life as a priest. And and this podcast is called Productivity Mastery. People want to learn how to be productive. So how was a regular week of yours looking like so you can perform as an effective priest? What does a effective priest mean to you? And how did you prepare? Because a lot of the part about productivity comes with preparation.
Yes. So we 10 years of preparation. People don't realize this. It depends. You know, 8 to 12 years of preparation to become a priest. And because of the
academic... What does that include? What does that include? Like, how do you practice? So what do you do to become a great priest?
Right. So I went through 2 years of novitiate, which is really like 2 years of boot camp. You know, if we think of the United States military, right? It's usually 3 or 4 months of boot camp, 2 years of intense physical and spiritual and mental bootcamp, where you really step away from the world. It's focused a lot on silence, on prayer, on connection with the transcendent, on getting to know yourself better. Also, there's some academics in there, you know, but it's really learning about the spiritual life, about how our spirit works and how we connect with the transcendent, you know, what we call God, how God connects to us as human beings, how to foster that relationship. And then, you know, we studied Latin, we studied Greek, and we studied, then we went on to classical humanities, then you get a bachelor's in philosophy, then we do some hands-on ministry work for a few years. It's also part of the growth process, part of the discernment process to understand if this is what I want to do. And then we do 3 years of theology. So it's a very, you know, extensive process. And then ministry brought me to, I was in Italy for 10 years in different periods of my life. I was in Colombia, South America, and Chile, and also in Ireland. And then it brought me also to the Navy as a naval chaplain.
Just hold on a second. So we're going to get there. But what were your core objectives on a weekly basis as a priest?
Yeah, so as a priest, first of all, so there's logistics, there's practical side, and then there's the what I would call the spiritual side. First of all, it's important as a priest, to religious figure, to stay connected to my mission, which is first and foremost to be connected to God, and to be a bridge between God and others. To be an instrument that leads people to that encounter with themselves, and that encounter with themselves in the light of the divine, in the light of God. So the first duty of a priest is the spiritual duty, to pray, to meditate, to stay connected, to be the best instrument that you can be. And then therefore, then the other element is then that teaching, preaching element, how to transmit the word, you know, whether it be, in our case, would be scripture or teachings of the church. In other religions, there would be other based foundational documents. But how do we transmit this to people in a nourishing way? Because this is food for the spirit. And it's not only food for the spirit, but it's also how to apply that to your life. Now, I could go on a tangent on how oftentimes
I think
that's, people that's don't such do a, this work. But yes.
I think that's such a, there's so many learnings for not only people who are priests or doing something in this area, but for, let's say, leaders, entrepreneurs. Like there's a few things I just want to point out. One, you learned that in order to be in your best possible state, you need to have your core practices and you need to be consistent with them.
Yes.
And I think this could be a great learning for anybody listening. It's about doing the things over and over again. I mean, if you just prayed once for 5 hours and then it's like, I already prayed. And next right. month I'm not praying. You know, I'm done. I know how to pray. It's probably not going to go so well.
That's right. It's a practice, like in many things, you know, exercise, go to the gym, sports, anything, you know, and we eat on a regular basis, don't we? Right. Because we want to nourish. Right. And if we believe that we have a spirit, so well, we want to nourish the spirit and soul. So as you said, there's like this core. And then when I talk to people, it's like, you know, you can usually name it on one hand. What are the core behaviors or habits that help you to show up your best? And for us, you know, in religious life, yes, so an hour of silent meditation every morning, right? Plus other formal prayers that we would have to do, you know, whether it be liturgical, like what is called Catholic Mass, what is called the breviary, right? And then another hour of prayer throughout the day, broken into different periods. You know, 8 days of silent retreat every year. And at one or two points in our life to do 30 days of silent retreat. So yeah, so it's, you know, and I think there's a book out there about Lessons of a Monk, right? Which by a very famous speaker and author. And it speaks to people because they're fascinated by that lifestyle, you know, this sort of like this mysterious lifestyle of a monk or of a priest. But there's so many lessons for any human being in our daily life of why those. So those practices become the foundation of what you build your day around. Then what else? Now it depends on what your job is as a priest. But I worked in directing seminaries, so a lot of my day was running, you know, just logistics and also making sure that our values, our vision, our mission, that I'm consistently teaching that, and that I'm teaching people about how to encounter themselves, how to encounter God, and how to be the best religious person and priest that they can be when they reach that stage.
Man, isn't that exactly what we were speaking about at the beginning of the podcast?
It is, yes.
You show up, you identify your core priorities and what are the practices that get you into your best possible state so you can show up as a leader and guide others and lead others. And then one of your core priorities is not only to have the best of intentions for yourself and be self-aware, but to be able to transmit this message and empower others, influence others, lead others. The power of communication, being influential as a leader. Because if you don't have people around you, you can be a leader, but you can be a lonely leader. Right. There's many tech founders out there that are exceptional genius in product, in tech, in many other things. And they're like, I'm just not a people person. But maybe you have to learn. Maybe you have to learn to be better in communication. You don't have to be extroverted, super upfront kind of person. No, I mean, actually, many of the best leaders out there, I'm very introverted,
Yes.
But they're impactful.
That's right. Yes. And if you're not, well, you know, and if you're not interested in leading people, then get someone on your team that can do that for you. So you can stay in your zone of genius of technology. Right. But it's interesting in the hierarchical process of, you know, promotion and traditional processes, people that are good in their technical abilities oftentimes are the ones that get promoted. And that's sometimes where we make mistakes because they're not the right person, you know, or let's promote you, but let's also give you the training and education and accompaniment so that you can learn how to lead people better. So my job, that was, you know, that's what I did. I ran organizations, but also in some, you know, in Colombia and in Ireland and England, I was also the national director of our operations. And so I wore a few hats, overworked, underpaid. We think about poverty, so actually we don't get paid. And that's where burnout sort of came from, that and from some other things.
How old were you at the time?
I was about, at that stage, probably about 38. And there was, and I'm going to talk, mistakes that I made over that time was, I mean, over those years was I lost, while I knew a lot about myself, I also lost connection with my emotional side. Because that wasn't, we didn't give a lot of importance to that, as oftentimes men don't, right? And in certain
states, let's stay here for a second. So losing connection with your emotions, in what way?
Okay, let me back up for a sec. So feelings and emotions can sometimes be equalized to maybe not important. And I was in part of an organization and a faith-based organization that sort of didn't give importance to them, right? There's a tendency in some areas where we over-spiritualize. And we can do this as human beings in different ways. It's called their defense mechanisms, right? To try to make sense of things. And so the way we made sense of negative emotions and feelings was, well, this is a trial. This is purification. This is the cross, whatever you want to call it, right? And so this is, I'm just meant to suck it up and to figure it out, right? And so what happens that leads you to disconnect from certain elements? I disconnected from certain elements of myself because I didn't know how to name those things. I didn't know how to deal with them. I didn't know what to deal with them. And in a certain way, it was like, those aren't good. So don't even talk about them. And this can happen in order. I know when I'm working in the military, this was also a common thing that I saw in the military. And so I don't think it's something that I learned a lot growing up, but then it was just reinforced being in this organization. Now, you asked, how did that happen? Or what did you ask?
Yeah, how did you lose connection with your emotions?
It's something, I think it was something that I didn't learn. It was something also in the environment that didn't promote it. It didn't give us permission to deal with those things. Often there was a few times when I wanted to talk about them and I was sort of shut down, right? Or, you know, don't pay attention to those.
So you stuck them up inside.
Yeah, you start to repress them and not deal with them. Another thing is, from an early age in this organization, I was given leadership roles. So I was really charged from an early age to take care of other people, which I did very well. But that gave me an excuse not to deal with my stuff.
Who's taking care of the leader?
Right. And I was like, well, I'm good at taking care of other people. The less I deal with my own stuff, then the better I'm going to be. But again,
you find stuff to be busy with,
right?
So you can focus on being there for others, maybe feel a little bit better about yourself because you help others, you support others, but then you avoid looking inside and actually dealing with the stuff.
Yes, that's the exact pattern. Right, and they can talk about, you know, sometimes they talk about the functional depressed person is someone who is somewhat depressed inside, but they either overwork themselves, they're always busy, they're always funny, making jokes about everything. In other words, we try to fill those holes or try to facade what we're going through. We put on this facade of I'm always busy, I'm always taking care of other people, I'm all, you know, overcommitting, or I'm always funny and have a good sense of humor, I'm always socializing. I'm not saying that any of that's negative. But if that's a facade behind which I can hide some of the deeper truths about myself, then it, at some point, as I said before, that will send a bill.
So what happened afterwards? Was that the motivation for you to join the U.S. Navy?
So no, so I took a year off. I did a lot of work on myself. At this point, in those years of working on myself, it was the first time that I, if I can use this expression, I had the courage to put this huge decision on the table. And like, is ministry, is formal ministry, is the priesthood the right place for me?
It was man, by the way, for those of you listening, these are a lot of years of your life that you've been doing that. You probably became part of your identity.
It's very much
a year or two. Oh. It's probably no, it's so huge. Hard, man.
In priestly life, in as with a lot of some organizations, it's not just a 9-to-5 job, it's a mission. It's an identity. It's 24/7. I didn't rest, have a vacation, didn't disconnect from my what we call professional life. 25 years. And that's because that's the commitment. And that's something that I was passionate about because, you know, I was totally committed to serving God and to serving other people. But I'm not saying that's a positive thing in the sense that I'm not taking care of myself. It was just the nature of the organization, the nature of what was expected. And again, it ends up leading to a lot of difficulties and pain that I had to deal with. And part of my story is very important is how I befriended pain. As human beings, we don't like pain. We don't like discomfort, right? And that's why we avoid it. That's why we want to put it away into a little closet. We want to, you know, but some things, some pain and discomfort and difficulties or experiences or trauma, when we put it into darkness, hoping it will disappear, it grows. And no matter how much we try to, it's going to grow and its stench will begin to invade, sort of it will poison our life and how we live or how we come across, even unconsciously. But anyway, so I took that as a year off to do a lot of work myself and to consider this big decision. I was very afraid to make that decision because it was a place that I never wanted to be in my life. You know, when I started my journey, I was like, I never want to be one of the people that walks away. I never want to be one of the, you know, a priest that is unfaithful. I don't want to be a priest who goes, who looks depressed, right? Who has problems. Right? And I became all of this.
What made you get to the point of no return? That it's like, despite all the pain, I'm right. Doing it.
I'm making a move. I just took me time. I needed a few years to work through it. I had to reconcile a lot of things theologically, spiritually, psychologically, mentally, emotionally, humanly, socially, because my decision affects a lot of people, beginning with family and extended circles and, you know, thousands of people that I worked with, that I ministered to in my life in different countries. And that meant a lot to me because people are important to me. But I also, you know, there's this, some codependency traits that I had. There's this sort of, you know, this one, the pleaser traits that I had. And so all that gets mixed in there in the making this decision more difficult.
Right? So what would be a recommendation? Like, there's a lot of listeners right now that are maybe reflecting on their own stories and maybe resonating with some of the examples that you share. What would be your recommendation and advice in terms of what would be the first step they should do if they want to make a change?
Oh, if they want to make a change in their life, don't make that decision alone. I learned through pain and discomfort, I had to lean on other people. And that was hard for me because I sort of built up this, you know, I was good at what I did. I became a little bit self-sufficient. And that's not a healthy thing for us as human beings. A healthy independence is good. Right. But if we become very self-referential, well, it's not, you know, and it's hard for us is to bring someone in, especially into those intimate, vulnerable spaces. But it's so interesting, you know, Stoyan, when as human beings, one of the ways that we process that, I mean, when we have thoughts, when we have experiences, when we have emotions, one of the ways, basic ways that we process this as human beings is when we transform it into words, whether it be writing or whether it be speaking. So trying to do things on our own, we're not fully processing what we're going through. That's why having someone in a confidential, safe space, you know, that we can talk about stuff and process what we're feeling, what we're going through, why things are difficult, why I don't want to do what I have to do, or why I do want to do what I have to do, those conflicting or paradoxes that we experience in us as human beings. We need someone through which, you know, where we can mirror ourselves. Now, this is hard for us as human beings, and it's more hard for us, and I don't want to generalize, but yes, as males, it's harder for us to invite someone into that space. We would prefer to do it on our own, as I wanted to do it on my own. But I was at such a low spot that I had to eat humble pie and say, no, I can't do this on my own. And if I want to, I had a bigger picture of, I want to live a good life. I want to be successful. I want to continue to serve people. So if I don't deal with this, I won't be able to do any of that. And not only that, there were many moments in those years that I just did not want to live. I wouldn't say that I was considering how to take my life, but I was in such darkness and pain. I was like, I wish I was not alive because I don't know what to do. I'm so confused. And so going back to your question, invite someone into that space because that's how you're going to process it. You know, as human beings, we are mysteries for ourselves. And part of how we uncover the mystery is through talking to another human being. Through the eyes of Stoyan, through you, I get to know more about myself. Through how you mirror back to me, through how the questions that you ask, through your affirmation, your validation, through your understanding, through your empathy, there's a connection and I get to know more about myself. And so these are things that we can't do on our own. So that would be my first recommendation.
Thank you so much, man. And we have a beautiful question coming from Marie, who's listening to the podcast live. Marie, thank you for being with us. So basically, she's stating the part of mission-based business is something a lot of startups are struggling with. How do you get out of your own head and see what the problem is?
Yeah, it's so, and thank you for that, Marie. Yeah, thank you for that. It part of the thing is, you know, even though we are experts in our business or whatever we do, oftentimes, like I said, we need the other person to help us get out of our head. I need to talk about things because in that, like going back, through a coach, I facilitate a process of discovery. Not that I know the answers, you have the answers, but I facilitate a process where you discover those answers. And so that's what getting out of my head is when I bring someone into, because oftentimes someone, and it's so interesting with us human beings, is someone outside of us oftentimes has a different and more accurate perception about what I'm going through. Right? Now, I'm not saying always, we have to be very careful about being judgmental, but oftentimes the eyes of another, going back to what I said, can reveal a lot to me about myself, a lot of blind spots. So in the business side, I think it's bringing someone into that because so you can get out of your head and you can sort of bounce things off of someone else. And almost just talking, you discover your answers. Or the person will say, hey, but have you thought about this? And have you thought about this? Helps you to get out of your head, look at four eyes, you know, and in 4 years, see and hear better than just two. And as human beings, it's common. We get stuck in our head and then we start spinning our wheels and we can get confused and then we can make poor decisions. Hopefully that answers somewhat the question.
It's a common struggle for entrepreneurs.
Of course.
Because when you start building something, okay, sometimes you have co-founders, partners, maybe advisory board, but it still can be very lonely. You cannot share all your struggles with your employees, with your mother, with your girlfriend, boyfriend, because maybe you have a different kind of relationship with these type of people, and there's emotion involved, there's different interests involved and history in there, and maybe they don't understand you because they have a different kind of lifestyle. So whether it's a coach, whether it's a mentor, whether you have some sort of a group of like-minded entrepreneurs, for example, where you can kind of have a safe space for somebody to offer a perspective to support you. Sometimes just to confirm and validate and just to say, that makes a lot of sense what you're doing. And you're like, oh, okay. And it's already it's like, boom. I'm not mad. I'm not crazy.
Right. Yes. We need that. We need, either mentorship groups or mastermind groups or networking groups or the services. And I'm not trying to sell my services here, but the services that I offer is precisely that. Because just what you said to your point is family family, friends, business partners, a board, people that I work with, peers or employees. We're always in those, all of those relationships, we're taking care of other dynamics at the same time. Right? We have to care for other dynamics. So we can't, we always have somewhat of a facade in each of those relationships, give or take. Now, the work that I do is I encourage people just to show up. The more you show up just as yourself with no facades, the more you're going to get out of our journey. Right? And it's a professional safe space where I'm not of any of those circles. I'm here just to serve you and to serve your agenda, and so that we can help you be the better, best person, best leader that you can be. So yes, so having that person. Now, sometimes we're caught in the middle. I don't have the finances because it can be expensive service. So that's, you know, sometimes we're caught with that. But other times it's just because you don't want to do it or you think you don't have the time. But believe me, it will benefit you greatly and professionally and personally.
So Matthew, we're going to the U.S. Navy part of the story. Why don't you tell us, how did you get there, and what did you learn being part of this organization? You know, first person perspective, you were there, you observed a lot. What can you share with us that can be helpful for the leaders listening?
Thank you. So, and I did this because I really wanted more time to make my decision, this big life decision. And because I would, for like 6 years, I was saying, I want to be a Navy chaplain. I want to serve those that serve. And so I was at this point where if I don't do it now, then maybe I'm never going to do it. And I didn't want to live with that regret of not being able to do it. So in that sabbatical year, I got to a much better place. I uncovered a lot. I grew a lot. And then I said, all right, now is my time. So I joined the Navy as a chaplain. And it was so many things about this, because first of all, just personally, it helped me mature my decision. Right? Sometimes as human beings, we can be very impulsive in making our decisions, especially when there's pain and discomfort. And we can make decisions from a negative place. And that was something I did not want to do. I wanted to make this very important decision from a good place. And I got to a very good place, so much so where I was very happy. I was content. I was enjoying what I was doing. I was enjoying ministry again, but I also knew that it wasn't my place. So that's why I did that. Now, in ministry, whether it be in the Navy, you participate in the highs and the happiest moments of people's lives, and sometimes the saddest and most tragic moments. So it's a very intense life, but very beautiful, because people invite you to walk on the sacred ground of their lives. Right? And to go back to what I said about that facade in ministry, you know, in the Catholic confessional, for example, and that's when people wear no masks. And there's something, so that's where I fell in love with the complex beauty of the human person. Mm. Because people want to be listened to, and people want to be seen in that complex beauty and without the masks. And so I was able to be in those spaces, not only in the confessional, but just in the counseling sessions and walking with people. And in the military, it's so beautiful because as a chaplain, I have access to everyone from, you know, the entry-level Marines. I was stationed at a Marine Corps base. So entry-level Marines to commanders and generals. You have access to everyone because you're not always...
What is your exact core responsibilities in there?
So as a chaplain, really, because of our Constitution, United States, a chaplain exists to protect and facilitate someone's religious freedoms. Every American has freedom to religious expression. So as a chaplain, even though I have a specific faith group, I make sure that all of my Marines and sailors have access to their faith practice. Okay. So I protect that and I facilitate that. And then I care for everyone at the command. So I worked at a command of about 5,000 Marines and sailors. And I was the chaplain. I was there to care for everyone. And usually it was caring for them in the more difficult moments. Yeah? In a mass of humanity, you're going to have challenges, right? Whether they're losing people at home, whether they're just going through a lot of stressful, it's a very stressful environment. So, and being a uniformed chaplain, it means a lot, because people like, this guy knows what we're going through. He understands. He's walking with us. He's marching with us. He's hiking with us. He's wearing our boots, right? And so they can open up a little bit, you know, because this is a very unique culture and mentality.
So you had to do it. You have to walk with them. You had to be with them. Like, it's not just you waiting in your room, in your office, and wait.
No, I have a great picture of my boots when I finished active ministry, because active duty, because my boots were my office. Yes, I had an office, but I needed to be with my people. Right. And so my boots were my office. And it could be hard for people, because, like, how do we find the chaplain? Well, I had a phone, right? So just call me and find my boots, right? Because that's where I'm going to be. Right. And because, you know, you're visiting people in the barracks, you're with the commanding officers in their office, you're visiting the classrooms, you're doing this, you're out, you know, you're meeting people where they're at, meeting people, not only physically, but meeting people where they're at spiritually, emotionally.
How do you get these people, tough people, right? Masculine, tough people. How do you get them to trust you?
Yes. That's hard. And not only, there's a lot of, in contrary to what we would think, there's tons of women in the military.
But it's still masculine energy, though.
Somewhat.
In many ways.
It is, yes. We have to be strong, right? Weakness is unacceptable, right? That's the contrast, that contradiction that we sort of have to shut down aspects of our humanity in order to live up to what is expected of, or what we think is expected of. I got to be a Marine. I have to be a sailor. I got to be like this. This is what, you know, and sort of like, and you are sort of psychologically or mentally or culturally punished if you have problems. Right? That's not the way it's, you know, that's not the values that are promoted, but that's sometimes what ends up happening, because we think that we have to be this, right? And so being human means that I'm weak. Weakness is unacceptable, so therefore I can't really be human, right? So we end up being killing machines, right? And as I would tell the Marines, well, that does not serve you well, that does not serve your loved ones well, and that does not serve our country well. The more you deal with yourself and with your humanity, the better you're going to serve our country, the better you're going to serve your loved ones. And, you know, part of the Marine Corps and part of the military is we want to return better citizens, and we haven't been good at that. Because we can return very hurt citizens and dysfunctional citizens. I'm generalizing. Oftentimes, it's more often than not, people go back as much better citizens. But oftentimes, people can also return very hurt. So how can we return better human beings into the civilian workforce and back to their loved ones? So how do we? And so that was my, you know, I would speak to Marines on a weekly basis. And that was, I would have this message that I would consider, that was the drum that I would beat, because that was the drum that I was meant to be. I was supposed to be that very human element in the command. You know, I was not a military expert, but I was an expert in the human person and how we can make people better. And so the other thing that I would do, I would advise commanding officers and senior enlisted on how to deal with situations, because they're trained to deal with combat and with military situations. And I would help them deal with human situations in a more functional way.
And when it comes to, you mentioned previously in the conversation, crisis. What would be your advice for, I mean, there's many, many founders listening, right? Many businesses, entrepreneurs here. And the last few years have been quite turbulent and uncertain. And there's so many things happening globally, with the economy, you know, geopolitically, and so on and so forth, like many crises, many situations of uncertainty, emergencies. What would be your advice to people who are going through a crisis, let's say a business crisis, to make it more specific? Right. How should they proceed? What would be your suggestion to them?
It depends on the nature of the crisis. But first of all, I think we have to be able to name it. There's something very important for us humans. When we can name something, because we bring it to the surface, we can find shame in that. We can find there's other negative, you know, emotions that we can, you know, we might not like to name a crisis, but we can serve ourselves better and serve our organizations better when we name it. This is, and then when we're able to bring the appropriate people into the process to try to better manage the crisis. Crisis management is huge, right? And how we manage it. First of all, preventive maintenance, I think, is very important, staying ahead of the game. But when a crisis happens, and crisis will happen, you know, and in Chinese, they use two different figures to explain the concept of crisis, you know, danger and opportunity, because it is a danger. And it's even more so of a danger if we don't manage it properly, right? But it's also an opportunity. And now as human beings, it's interesting because the brain, when we're in the face of a crisis, our brain sort of narrows its vision. It's sort of almost, I wouldn't say it shuts down, but it narrows its vision because we get into protective mode, safety and protective mode. That's the last thing we need in a moment of crisis. We need to broaden our vision. And that's why bringing people into the picture, and oftentimes in moments of crisis, we're like, well, I don't have time to do it, or I don't know who to do it, I don't trust people, or it's I feel shameful and humiliated by this crisis, so I don't want to. Well, you might die on that hill of humiliation and shame, right? Rather than growing through this.
Do you have any personal, you know, maybe quirky practices, not quirky, but practices that if you are faced with a crisis, with a situation, with emergency, do you have any kind of tools to immediately bounce back to a more broader perspective from a better mental state?
Yes. I think that this practice, again, self-awareness is important. And then this practice of what's the bigger picture? To force ourselves into what's the end goal? What do I want to achieve? Right? Because
so
we
asking
can
better questions.
Right?
Asking better questions.
We can sink into a crisis, right? And we can get stuck or we can just freeze. All right, what's the bigger picture? Right. And what decisions now will help me get to the bigger picture? And not what decisions will help me get out of this crisis or get out of the pain, but what decisions will help me get to my bigger goals and bigger picture?
Thank you so much, Matthew. And for those of you being with us to the end of the episode, thank you for being with us. Thanks for listening. If there was something that specifically stuck with you, do make sure to send us a message. I'm very reachable on LinkedIn. I'm just going to give the word to my guest to also share where people can get in touch with him. But make sure to send a message, post a comment somewhere under the stream if you're watching us live on LinkedIn, or send an email if you're listening to the podcast on any of the other platforms. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click subscribe so you'll be notified for any new episodes. This is episode 169 of Productivity Mastery. So there's 168 more episodes with fantastic leaders like Matthew. Matthew, final question. Where could people find you, get in touch with you, and connect?
Thank you, Stoyan, for this opportunity. So bracketalliance.com is my email, is my website. And they can find me on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, all under Matthew Brackett.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Matthew, for sharing all these learnings. To everybody else, have an amazing day and let's keep performing. Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing. We'll be right back.